Hey everybody, welcome to the Ultra High Net Worth Clients Podcast, where I, Chris Broadhead, interview the most successful financial advisors in the world to hear exactly how they maximize their marketing, amplify their assets under management, and close their ultra high net worth clients. I've been helping financial advisors to find more clients and grow their assets under management using cutting edge and wildly effective marketing strategies for years. If you are a financial advisor looking to grow your AUM, this is the podcast for you. Please go to uhnwc.com to download your free copy of our How to Find Ultra High Net Worth Clients ebook. All right, let's start the episode. All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Ultra High Net Worth Clients podcast. I'm your host, Chris Broadhead. Today, we have the pleasure of talking with Daryl Lyons. Daryl, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you?
Yeah, Daryl Lyons, CEO and co-founder of Pax Financial Group. I'm from the San Antonio area and grew up around South Texas, kind of the area that's San Antonio and south towards the border and some of the small towns I lived in there. And currently live in New Braunfels, which is just slightly north of San Antonio.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Awesome. Which also isn't far from Austin as well.
No, we're right between. Yeah, I get to enjoy both of the towns.
Nice.
I'm partial to San Antonio, though.
Yeah.
I like my Spurs.
Yeah. That's awesome. So can you tell us how you got into this wild world of financial investing?
Yeah. So, I remember when I was in high school, we had a little single wide trailer on the side of the highway and off Highway 90 in a town called Castroville, small little Texas town, Friday Night Lights kind of stuff. And I'm edging the mobile home, and you have plastic skirting, and you got to be careful that you don't get the weed eater too close or you'll crack the skirting. And I thought, you know, how do people have houses with foundations? And so I kept thinking about that. And one of my friends, her dad was a banker, and he had a nice house with a foundation. They did as a family. And I thought, well, I guess I'm going to be a banker. That's sounds like I can get a house at the foundation. So I went to St. Mary's University, and there was a bank right next to the university. And I went there like six or seven times to ask for a job, and they kept losing my resume, but they finally gave me a job. I was very, very persistent. And that's how I paid my way through school. So 35 hours a week, I was very consistent for 4 years. And got a degree in accounting, another one in finance, and then went to do some graduate work later. But I ended up abandoning the banking career path. At the time when I graduated, Nations and Bank of America had this mega merger, and all my key contacts had lost their job. And so there was a little unsettling feeling. So I took my accounting and finance degree in the banking background, and I kind of explored career paths, and I came up with a career in a certified financial planner. And I had no idea what that was, by the way. But I thought I have some inclinations towards this career path. So I started working at a big firm, and I was doing really well, rookie of the year, partner of the year, moving up to Chicago or Dallas or New York. And I decided that that wasn't for me. And I wanted to raise my family in the San Antonio area and wanted to be a business owner. So I quit and got married and started with a couple other guys, Pax Financial Group. It's Latin for peace. And we started that, 2007 now.
Wow. Okay. Right before the party started.
Yeah, I know. Timing of it. Yeah. I started in the industry in 99. So that was like .com kind of stuff. And then that bubble burst. So I feel like I've been battle tested in a lot of these economic ups and downs. And so as we're going through one now, I don't like it. It's frustrating, but I never thought I'd get to the place where I feel emotionally disconnected. I'm very cerebral about it now. And that just comes with life and immaturity. And but it doesn't discount the fact that clients get emotional. So I have to play that role. And we have 25 employees. So I have 10 other advisors. So sometimes advisors will get emotional. I just have to be, you know, real steady and cerebral and use deductive reasoning and logic and draw conclusions. And those skills have just been built because of the many years of not responding that way and being emotional and regretting some of the decisions that were rooted in emotion. So I'm thankful for those. I'm thankful for those times. They made me who I am today.
Yeah. I mean, talk about trial by fire. Do you have any specific strategies for staying rational and not emotional during kind of these wild swings?
Yeah. Good question. there's product strategies, there's financial planning strategies, and then there's also business acumen strategies, right? So I can discuss any of those. But the business acumen is, I really like to root myself. I've got like key phrases that I use that my team can repeat. You can see behind me, I've got these phrases even on my wall. You probably can't see it from that angle, but like one of them is high emotion leads to low financial IQ. And these are just things that you've just got to constantly repeat to yourself and others. I tell my team almost every day, you think different when you think long-term. So in my mind, a strategy to your point is being the chief reminding officer of reminding myself and others of key principles that have been timeless. Now, those that know me, I am a Bible beater. So I've read the Bible many times. There's over 2,000 scriptures in money. And many of those have influenced me and give me a principles that also guide me. So, I mean, I am a principle-based guy. So I repeat those things to myself and my team, and then they use that to guide them and weather the emotional ups and downs.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Any great insights from the Bible having to do with money that come to mind?
Oh, goodness. There's so many. I mean, one of them is just as simple as, I think it's in Luke 14:28. It says, who first built a tower without counting the cost and estimating how much it'll cost to build? I mean, I know that's real simple, but that's just practical stuff. Like, you know, sit down, let's pencil this thing out. That's 2,000 years old, right? It's just, yeah. You know, let's think through this. Let's see if the math works. Let's see if the economics work. Let's not make decisions on emotions or ideas that sound good. Or even like when I was early in the business, I'd meet a wholesaler that would come in. This was back in the day, and he'd pitch me an investment strategy. He sounded good. The investment strategy sounded good. But at the end of the day, there really wasn't much evidence to support that that would translate into a future in performance. So I think just, you know, we've got the Word of God that gives us some very logical reasoning, and there's tons of them. I mean, there's so many. You know, I even think about Solomon. He was the richest man in the history of the world. And God said to him, because you didn't ask for riches or honor or the death of your enemies, and you didn't ask for a long life, but instead you asked for wisdom and knowledge to be able to rule over the people that I've made you king. And I just think about that too, about how important it is. Solomon didn't ask God for riches or honor, but rather asked for knowledge and wisdom. So I think that if we kind of anchor ourselves into wisdom and how do we, you know, gain wisdom in this business and where can we go for wisdom, the money may or may not come, but I think it's a worthwhile pursuit, because I've seen a lot of dumb people accumulate wealth, and it only accentuates their foolishness, and then it magnifies. I've worked with lottery winners and very wealthy people, and or people that have inherited money, and money only amplifies poor behavior. It only amplifies bad habits. It only amplifies bad people. And so I think that pursuit of wisdom, how can I refine myself in such a way that I'm not so self-centered? And then when you do receive money, you're a good steward of it. And so that's what I've seen over the years working with, I mean, kneecap to kneecap, I've worked with tens of thousands of people, and I've been very poor and I've been very rich. And I really would say that idea of Solomon really anchoring to wisdom, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wisdom comes first before wealth.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So I want to take a step back. You said when you started, you were rookie of the year for your company you worked for. Can you tell us, you know, some of your strategies for finding clients when you started?
I mean, I don't know if they work. So the thing about it was when I graduated, the day after I went to work for this company, and I honestly thought they were going to give me a salary. And when I didn't get my check, I realized that was on commission only. And I just totally misinterpreted that. Like, I thought I was getting a salary and here I am commissioned. So I'm in this bullpen and I look at the girl next to me and I said, hey, did I misunderstand now? I thought I was getting like $2,000 or $2,500 a month. She goes, no, I thought so too. So it wasn't just me. It was her also. I think we just got pitched, and it was a Yeah. Anyway, so I was like, well, what do I do now? Do I quit? And I was like, nah, I'm not going to quit. I'm gonna try this thing. So I did, but I only knew college kids and people in trailer parks. So my idea of getting clients was knocking on doors. I was like, I didn't know anybody rich. So I knocked on thousands of doors. I mean, I got kicked out of high-rise buildings, mobile home parks, residential areas. I mean, I was like Edward Jones on fire. And so I was 6 months into the business and I hadn't got any business. So they gave me a notice saying, hey, if you don't close X amount of business in a few months, then you're out of here. And I was like, well, dude, I need to get something. So this was awesome. I bumped into this guy and I had just started to anchor to this thing, maybe even a sales pitch that they taught me about buy sell agreement, didn't know much about it. But I threw everything at him and he said, yeah, we need a buy sell agreement. I was like, man, thank God. So I brought in a guy with some gray hair. He helped me close the deal, gave me enough momentum to keep my job. And then after that, I started pitching those buy sell agreements a lot more. And I started funding life insurance. That was kind of my angle. I was funding life insurance policies and I kind of figured that out. But I would just get business owners just by knocking on doors. And then I would say I got like, it was crazy. This one lady, as an example, her name was Sandy. She didn't buy anything from me or invest anything, but she would give me referrals all the time. Maybe she liked me, I don't know. But she would give me referrals all the time. So I would get a referral to her attorney, and then I would ask that attorney for referrals. And then it wasn't long before with these people I was knocking on doors, I had this huge, I had like hundreds of people in my database because I just kept asking for referrals. Every cheesy referral strategy that was out there, I did and tried. I had no pride because I was like, man, I had nothing to lose. I was a poor kid from not much. I had nothing to lose. I had no pride. I just wanted to make it in this world. My goal was make $66,000 a year, and I thought that was good enough. But I say all that because my strategy was just kind of a relentless pursuit more than anything. Probably something I wouldn't do again today, that's for sure. Maybe.
So wait, this is our 20-something interview, and I've heard a lot of relentless pursuit stories, but I think you're the first door-to-door who was relentless enough to do that. So man, cojones on you, brother.
Well, they'd say that I little integrity issue, but they'd say like, okay, no soliciting. I'd walk in, they say, hey, didn't you see that? No, I didn't see it. I did everything like I could figure out. I remember, like, I even now I'm like, man, that was probably an integrity violation. I shouldn't have done it. Like, I would call car dealerships because I was like, man, those guys are making money. So I'd call them and I'd say, hey, I was in there the other day and your top salesman, what was his name? And then the lady would say, oh, James Smith. Yeah, James Smith. Can I speak to James Smith? And they would just give me the name of the top salesman. I figured he was making money. So then I would pursue that James Smith.
Ah,
So, I mean,
clever.
it was a lot of clever. It was a lot of trying and failing. And, but, like I said, I ended up becoming Rookie of the Year and then Partner of the Year. I had like 10 people, that was 12 that were really working and producing underneath me. But the career path was clearly I was going to a big city, and I just this is home for me, and I don't have an appetite for really fancy things and a fancy lifestyle, to be honest. I like nice things, but not what I think, not where I was headed.
Keep it simple.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So when did the idea materialize, like, oh, I want to start my own thing? It was like,
Well, it never was lost on me when, in the 80s, when we had the SNL savings and loan crisis, and San Antonio was not immune to that. There was an oil crash, SNL crisis. This was 87. My mom had me when she was 16. My dad was 20, so they didn't have much of an education. And so, my dad was doing good in his business, but he worked for a company. And then that SNL crisis happened. He put his key in the door to go show up to work one day, and it didn't work. And they basically fired him. That was like the tipping point in our family's history that I remember financially. We struggled from then on. That was, we had a nice house, we had a boat, we had some cars. But at that point, I mean, I just remember that was kind of like the point in my life where I saw my dad cry. And I thought, well, I never want to work for somebody again if that's going to happen to me. That was my thinking. Yeah. And so that never lost on me as I was in this career path. And that was part of the catalyst for me to start PAX. And so me and two other guys, so three of us, we ended up getting together and we started PAX. And that was in 2007. We left a big firm. And we wanted our independence because we felt that there was some conflicts of trying to sell product through us. It was hard to be an independent advisor when you always had to sell something.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to pursue that independence. And I bought one of them out very amicably. He's a dear friend today. I talked to him today. But the two of us stayed, and then we've since added other partners to the organization.
Awesome.
Long answer, short question. Sorry to be so...
No, these are great. That's what I want. So 2007, you start PAX. You're like, everything's going to be good. Certainly, there won't be the largest swing correction in 100 years.
Yeah.
How'd you guys maintain?
Honestly, we hooked up with Dave Ramsey, you know, the national syndicated talk show host. We were one of his early endorsed local providers. I don't know if you're familiar with that program, but he's the national syndicated talk show host out of Nashville, a self-proclaimed, you know, hillbilly. He needed somebody to send leads to, so he sent it to us. And man, during 2007, 2008, when people were nervous, they came to us. And we were seeing a lot of people, and that was a blessing. So we were just seeing people left and right. 2007, 2008, we were just, I mean, I was probably seeing six people a day, and wow. It was just one after another, but it was all like A shares. So American funds. So that's how the economic system and the financial advisory system worked at that day. You know, those times people came in, you got a commission for selling American funds, whatever product. The actually more trying time was 2011 when we made an attempt to be a little bit more sophisticated. I think we were just trying new things. And 2011, we started to, it was a tricky time period because we had a decade, 2001 to 2011, where you looked at the decade and it was called the lost decade of the S&P 500. And we were becoming concerned that we were no longer able to bring value to anybody's life if we continue to have a stock market with zero return. So we were like, we got to do something different. And at that time, we weren't the only ones thinking this way. So this algorithm trading started to become prolific in our industry. And so we subscribed to these algorithms. We hired a hedge fund manager. We subscribed to the technician stuff, where red lights you sell, green lights you buy. And we actually adopted that. Clients, we did some presentations. Clients said, yeah, we like that. We're tired of zero returns. We want something different. So we did that. But in 2011, right in the summer, Greece was about to collapse. The European Union came last second and bailed them out. But it caused a whipsaw where the green lights and red lights were flashing left and right. And we were trading and losing money, not just like minor losses, permanent losses of capital. You know, when Apple goes down, you expect it to eventually go back up. But when you're trading and you sell at a loss, that's a permanent loss. So that was 2011. That was actually harder than 2007. For 2007, ignorance was bliss. But 2011, we had actually made some mistakes. And it wasn't like integrity mistakes. It was, there was a lot of everybody that was doing this type of investment approach was in a pickle because of the whipsaws. So, but that set us back a little bit, not only in our confidence, but on our clients' confidence in us. So it took us years to recover out of that. But eventually we did, and we were able to kind of course correct, and kind of, that's a part of us going back to principles of investing, focus more on crock pot investing than microwave investing, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That sounds like a expensive lesson. That was very thoroughly learned, maybe.
Dude, it was so expensive. It was so stinking expensive. Oh my gosh. Like, I've just, like, I, man, you know, just all the things that I've done over the years, like, man, what an idiot, but I'm so thankful I'm still here today to survive. And I do my best to learn from these things. Like, I don't let those lessons, I tell my kids, hey, you don't lose, you learn. And I'm just so thankful to be here today and take these lessons and actually help people. Like, I feel like I'm pretty equipped to be able to say, man, I've been down there. Let's not do this. yeah, it's made me, I'm thankful that I'm still here alive to be able to serve people. It's been, I mean, sincerely a blessing.
Amen. So throughout your career, did you focus on a certain type of client that you felt you could serve best? And if so, you know, why'd you choose them?
We don't necessarily, we focus on a specific client. We have 1500 households. We have a lot of different demographics. We've got people just starting out. We've got ultra high net worth people. But you know, we tend to gravitate towards that business owner. You know, my parents, since the challenges that they've had, they've started businesses. My brother started a business. My sister started a business. You know, here I am at PAX. So I am endeared to the business owner. So we do have a 401k division. We do have a group health division. And we just started a business succession consulting engagement service. So we do find ourselves very equipped. And as a competitive advantage, because we are business owners and we, you know, we're dealing with this stuff all the time, you know, whether it's payroll or finding out tech systems or whatever, we're dealing with business owner kind of stuff. So we're endeared to the small business owner. I've lobbied for small business through National Federation of Independent Business Owners, both in Texas and DC. And so that's the space that we tend to do well in. And so if anything, I would suggest to you, it's the small business owner.
Small business owner, you see yourself, you see your family in them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a grind, you know, and you know, your identity's in it. And
yeah,
I'm trying to figure out, we've got a great service, but I'm really trying to figure out how I can really carve out a niche, so to speak, and being able to help them with the succession planning, because there's some key elements there that I want to be able to adopt. And we've got a good service offering there, but I don't think that we've been able to get the word out as much as we'd like. And so going forward, that's something I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And you mentioned some larger clients. To the extent that you're comfortable sharing, can you tell us how you found your ultra high net worth clients?
Yeah. You know, you just find them different ways, honestly. We find that that's red ocean. So in other words, you know, that's where the sharks are at. That's where the blood's at, is in those ultra high net worth clients. So what we do is we tend to work just kind of right under that, so to speak. And then those people become ultra high net worth. So I would suggest to you that our target hasn't been that. I was talking to somebody just the other day in our office, one of the partners. I said, like, I'm just not targeting that red ocean. That's, let other people play there. It's very competitive. There's a certain cult of personality there. So we work under the ultra high net worth, just slightly under that. And then those we've had become our high net worth. So like somebody may have 10 million with us. And I, you know, people define it differently, these net worth numbers, but maybe 10 million with us. And then they're like, okay, we've been with you long enough. Now we're going to bring you over 50 million. Okay. So stuff like that happens.
Mm.
So, or a guy, you know, you have 3 million. Okay. Now we're going to bring over the rest. So that's kind of how we play the game, is like earning their trust. And then eventually we get family. We will get a lot of the other family. Or we'll get the trust account, or we'll get the other stuff. So they start out like just below the ultra, and then they move up, so to speak. So our target is not the ultra. We just, that's just not our target, but our clients become that.
That's genius, Errol. I've not heard that strategy yet. So that's really, really smart. How do you identify these folks, like the pre ultra, yeah, and then get on their radar?
Yeah, a lot of them are business owners. So you think about just us being able to speak that language, so to speak. So a lot of them, we one of the areas that I think is helpful to us is creating a system to be able for the non-CFO spouse to have a voice. So if we can help the non-CFO spouse, usually the wife, who's not privy to these conversations about money, really just spends, or, you know, just trust her husband, we need to engage with her and be a trusted resource. If anything happens to that business owner, she needs somebody to turn to, and we want to be that person. So that's really one of the places that we try to put our foot in the door for the business owner, because the business owner believes he can do it all on his own. Until we ask him and tell him, we're doing this right now with an ultra high net worth client. Until we say, if something happens to you, she's not going to have a clue. Let us play a role in some capacity in your life. But once we do that and they realize that we're on the same team and we can provide value, the door's open. But it's really engaging with that non-CFO spouse and engaging and listening and hearing what's important to her and inviting her to the dialogue and to the table. Once we're able to do that, I think that allows us to really be an expert in that space.
Another very clever strategy there, Daryl. Daryl, I could literally ask you questions for the rest of the afternoon, but I will respect your time. We'll have one final question. The question is, what are you working towards?
Oh, it's such a great question. I'm working towards the dad that God's called me to be. 100%. Yeah, I really want to wake up one day and be proud of how I've invested, not in my company or even in the market, but how I've invested in the lives of my children.
That's beautiful. And the conversation we had before the recording, I would say you are on that path, my friend.
Thank you.
Awesome. Appreciate that. Yeah. And where can our audience find out more about you?
PAX Financial Group, PAXfinancialgroup.com. I also have a podcast too, Retire in Texas. So I do a lot of content on there. So there's a couple places.
Great. Awesome. We'll be sure to link to that in the show notes. Daryl, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. This was awesome, man.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. And to all the listeners out there, thanks so much for tuning in. Keep on growing out there, everybody. See you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you enjoyed the ideas shared here, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes and Spotify. Please share this episode with anyone you think will also find value here. You can find short video clips of the best moments from the episode at uhnwc.com and on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at Ultra High Net Worth Clients, and on X at UHNWC Podcast. Please connect with me, Chris Broadhead, Brodhead, on LinkedIn so I can directly answer any AUM growth questions you may have. All right, thanks for listening and keep on growing out there, everybody.